Okay, I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:33 p.m. on Thursday, May 20th, 2021. Present today, we've got Representative Thompson, Representative Lobon, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Merrick, Representative Josephson, Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. Just a reminder, if folks could please mute their cell phones. And today's presentation is an overview of the U.S. Treasury Fiscal Relief Guidance, and it'll be presented by Neil Steininger, Director of Office of Management and Budget, as well as Paloma Harbor, a Fiscal Management Analyst. And if you could both go ahead and come on up and put yourselves on the record. Sure, thank you for being here today. And are you okay with questions along the way, or would you rather, okay, so if folks have questions, we'll take them as we go. And go ahead and put yourselves on the record.
For the record, Neil Steininger, Office of Management and Budget.
For the record, Paloma Harbor, Fiscal Management Analyst with the Office of Management and Budget.
To start off, because we have quite a few things and there's a lot of detail and information in the guidance, and we have an agenda laying out just the order of how we're going to go through things in this presentation. First, we'll cover the allocations coming to the state, the language on eligible use and restrictions, information from the preliminary guidance, which was released between the last time we've been to this committee to speak about ARP funding and now, as well as some information on kind of the follow-up and the next steps that we see forward, a bit about the capital project funds, and about funding going to tribal governments throughout the state of Alaska. So through the discretionary money coming into the state of Alaska, there's $1.25 billion granted to the state of Alaska or other entities within the state of Alaska through the American Rescue Plan Act. Attachment 1 gives some more detail, but here on this summary table, you can see that the state itself receives a little over $1 billion. And one thing to note is this number is slightly lower than the initial estimates that were provided and released when ARP was first passed at the federal level. The subsequent guidance on May 10th slightly reduced the amount going directly to the state and just redistributed some of these amounts to the other census areas, non-entitlement units, and metropolitan cities. You can also see here which items require an appropriation by the legislature and which items will flow to the entity without any actions by the legislative body or the state of Alaska. So this slide should be familiar from the last time that we came before the committee. This is the language from the Act itself, laying out the four main categories for allowable spending, as well as the two primary restrictions included in the language of the American Rescue Plan. The following slide, they're going to go into detail on the A, B, C, and D of the allowable uses and what we know now based on the interim final rule that was released on May 10th. But just to recap, A is to respond to the public health emergency and economic impacts. B is to respond to workers who are performing essential work during the public health emergency. C is for the provision of government services. This is that revenue offset piece that has been talked about. And then D is to make necessary investments in water, sewer, or broadband infrastructure. And the primary restrictions are direct or indirect offsets to a policy decision to reduce net tax revenue, as well as restriction on deposits directly into a pension fund. So in the interim final rule, it had some additional information about the time period, the covered period that these funds can be spent during. So previously, our understanding was it could be on any activities that occurred between March 3rd and December 31st, 2024. However, the interim final rule included some information allowing for funds to be obligated until December 31st of 2024, but the cost not to be incurred until or closed out until the end of calendar year 2026. So that does add a little bit additional flexibility in the types of things that can be done with this money. Additionally, they clarified that payments are intended to be used prospectively, so for costs into the future and looking forward for, you know, economic recovery and recovering out of the pandemic. However, the one area where that's a little bit different is for premium pay for essential workers. They'd like the state to consider, if doing premium pay for essential workers, to consider work that was performed throughout the period of the pandemic. Additionally, the revenue loss estimates, which we have several slides later on the calculations, are both retrospective and prospective, so meaning revenue lost during the course of the pandemic and revenue that we may lose in the future as a result of the pandemic.
Mr. Steininger, you've got to cover costs incurred beginning on March 3, 2021, and I thought that we could start for any costs that were incurred. I thought it was last year, March of 2020, but you've got 2021?
Chair Foster, the interim final rule clarified that it's March 3rd of 2021. So the March of 2020 was under the CRF, the CARES Act funding, and that allowed, I believe it was March 23rd. I think it was March 23rd was the start date of that funding.
Okay, yeah. So under CARES, that covered that period, ARPA, CARES, covers this new period. Thank you, Representative right. Josephson.
Through the chair, following up on that, Mr. Steininger, I thought that one of our better and more creative arguments was a slight dip in oil severance tax in FY 19 and 20. And so that argument has gone away. And the delta with our current revenue.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the revenue loss estimates, so that dip in oil in that time period, we're allowed to look retrospectively on the revenue loss estimates, but then the expenditure justified through that revenue loss would be prospective. So we can count that revenue loss to use of the funds for future expenditures.
Representative Ortiz.
Same would hold true for revenue losses for municipalities, et cetera. You can retrospective on that.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that's correct.
Thanks. Okay.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you. So did we learn more about the state certification process, the 60-day period through the interim guidelines? Do we have an understanding of whether that really, I mean, does that just apply to us receiving the funds itself, but not any eligibility sort of aspect tied to it?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, the 60-day certification was the time period to actually have the Division of Finance get onto the Treasury's website to certify and to allow for the receipt of the funds. And I think Ms. Harbor might have more information on that.
Ms. Harbor?
For the record, Paloma Harbor, through the chair, Representative Edgman, I think the director answered your question, I believe, which is, Treasury opened the certification portal on May 10th when they released this guidance, and we were allowed to certify for the funding at that time. The state did submit our certification, and we actually received the funding on Monday, May 17th. We can't spend the money until there's an appropriation, but we've already received the state funding. And the portal was also opened for boroughs and metropolitan cities to receive their funding. When we submitted our certification for the state funding, Treasury assumed that certification was also being applied for the non-entitlement unit funding for the smaller cities and for the census areas. So we've technically already submitted our certification for that funding, but they are not going to distribute that funding until they release additional guidance on how they want that funding distributed, which they have not yet released. Any questions on that?
Very interesting. So we had a bill in front of this committee. I think it passed and allowed us to get more creative with short-term financing mechanisms. But I can't imagine we can use the federal money and use that to invest in short-term instruments.
Arbitrage.
Arbitrage, yes.
Just for the record, earlier we had both Representative Edgeman stop in, as well as we've got here, and also Representative Wool. So with that, Mr. Seininger.
Okay, again, Paloma Harbor. So I'm going to talk in a little bit more detail about the eligible uses of the funding that were clarified in Treasury's preliminary guidance. As the director mentioned, this is preliminary guidance, and it will change when they come out with their final rule, but hopefully not substantively, and so these will be good frameworks to use as we develop programs. So the first area under the Act, the funding could be used to respond to the public health emergency, and the guidance clarified that what fits under that categorization. One thing to mention is that the guidance gave non-exclusive lists or examples, and then they said the recipients can determine other things that are similar and use it that way. So it wasn't exclusive lists. So COVID-19 mitigation and containment expenses, medical expenses, behavioral health care expenses, and this is to help deal with the mental health and substance abuse of side effects of COVID, and then also for public health and safety staff costs when they're working on COVID. And so it's important to know that this is more restrictive than the CARES Act funding was. Under CARES Act, we could presume all public health and safety employees were working on COVID because it was such a big deal at that time. Now, you know, that it's winding down, you do have to have supported payroll documentation behind the public health and safety workers being primarily working on COVID in order to claim their time. Any questions? Okay. Under the second part of A, we were also able to use this funding for the negative economic impacts of COVID. The Treasury guidance does clarify that they want programs that are very clearly addressing COVID impacts. And you either have to, the program has to show that it's addressing COVID impacts by addressing unemployed workers or addressing tourism, travel, and hospitality, things in the Act that they specifically call out. If you have a program like small business relief, then there's documentation behind that that shows what's the COVID impact, how are you addressing it, and we have to maintain that documentation for Treasury. If you pick an industry besides tourism, travel, or hospitality, then you have to conduct an analysis of how much were they impacted compared to those other industries, why did you choose to aid them, and how much were they impacted by COVID versus natural trends that were happening without COVID. And so they are pretty strong in the documentation that we'll have to keep in support of our programs. If I could say one more thing before we go to questions, on this slide. So under one thing we weren't expecting on this was the negative impacts to the public sector. And they did under here say that we could replenish our unemployment trust fund up to our pre-COVID level, which would be over $200 million if we chose to do that. So that was just something that they put in the guidance.
Okay. Got a question from Representative Wool and then Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I guess on the issue of negative impacts directly related to COVID, tourism, travel, hospitality, I guess I understand that. Community like Juneau or Ketchikan, any of the cruise ship affected destinations, their whole economy is affected. And I don't know what secondary or tertiary level someone would have to document, you know, the hardware store, the business is down, or so on and so forth, the ripple effect of that. And you have to also weigh that, maybe not so much in these communities, but communities that are affected by negative sort of recession. Alaska's been in for a number of years, that the economy itself, even pre-COVID, I mean, you have to calculate all this in. And I guess more urgently, like Juneau, obviously there's restaurants, but the maybe other levels of industry or the economy that have been affected.
Oh, absolutely. Through the chair, Representative Wool. So all we have to do is when we're establishing these programs, these grant programs, we just have to have reasons for why we're targeting who we're targeting. And we can obviously show that it was more than just tourism, travel, and hospitality. There were ripple effects. And I know our Department of Revenue did an economic analysis of the impact of losing the cruise ship industry and specifically looked at that. And so we could use that in support of our programs. But then when we do something like small business relief, we need to have the criteria in the program that says, show us your revenue loss, show us your whatever, and so that we have that documentation to support ourselves in an audit. Does that make sense?
Thank you. I'm sorry, Representative Ortiz first, and then Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So as a part of the process, am I correct in understanding then, even businesses that are obviously directly related to tourism, they still would need to submit, in order for them to receive funds, they'd need to submit evidence of economic loss.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that's correct. In fact, the guidance specifically says they don't want us to over-support impacted industries. So you have to measure the impact and then address that impact and not overly address it.
Follow up?
And what about the area where maybe economic loss per se is not documented, but investment was required in order to deal with COVID? Would that qualify? So in other words, there might not be a, I'm thinking about in the fish processing industry. You know, I was contacted by constituents in that area, and they talked about how while they can't document loss, they can document specific investment requirements in order to be, quote, COVID safe. Would that apply?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, of course it matters on how we develop the program, but yes, those are impacts of COVID, the public health emergency, that we could offset those costs for businesses.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson?
Well, this is likely not workable, but I noticed in the other body yesterday there was bipartisan support for a proposal adopted in some other states very recently to give money as an incentive to return to work. It was a $10 million amendment. I guess it's in the Senate version of 69 now, and I didn't know whether that might be coverable under an unemployment trust fund kind of concept, or I don't know if you had a thought on that.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there's very strict rules on usage of the unemployment insurance trust fund, so I don't believe we could use that for stimulus type payments. I think we have to meet the federal guidelines related to the UI trust, which is just unemployment benefits, and they have to match our statutory requirements for those. But under addressing the negative impact, economic impact to unemployed workers, that's definitely something they call out as, if it's a program for unemployed workers and trying to get them re-employed, that's something they encourage.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Could it be, and I know there's various budgets around, but some were given small business, say, $180 million, or I'm just coming up with that number. I know there's different budgets that give, quote-unquote, small business, you know, let's say it's $100 million. Is it possible that due to the restrictions and rules that it won't be able to be spent?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I'm not sure I understood the question. So is it possible if we set up a small business program that we wouldn't have enough demand for it? Is that?
Through the chair. In other words, you're saying you have to show, you know, direct correlation with COVID and show your receipts and show how much revenue you lost and all this. And if at the end of the day, all the businesses that apply and get the grants, it doesn't add up to, I forget what the governor's number was for business support.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It was a couple hundred million or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so what if I mean, is it going to be one of those situations where, well, we have this money, but we can't use it all?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, so we could establish a program. Let's say it was $100 million for small businesses, and if the demand was not there after a fiscal year, the legislature could reappropriate that funding. We have 4 years, but we have until December 31, 2024 to spend this money. So.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, so underneath the eligibility criteria of addressing the negative economic impacts of COVID, Treasury really focused on those hardest hit by COVID, which based on their analysis is low income and minority groups. And so what they did is they provided a list, again, a non-exclusive list of additional services you can provide to those more significantly impacted individuals, and it will be presumed to be eligible. And so there's quite a list of services. The way that they've chosen to define those low-income areas is by neighborhood or qualified census tract, which is, and I had to write, I'm going to read. Okay. Qualified census tracts have 50% of households with incomes below 60% of the area median gross income, or have a poverty rate of 25% or more. So if you live in a neighborhood that meets those criteria, and HUD is where this definition was developed, so it's an existing program or an existing definition that they chose to use for this, then we can provide additional services to those areas, and they're presumed eligible. And the types of programs we can provide are things like community health workers to help community members access health services, investing in housing services like lead paint remediation or homelessness assistance, addressing educational disparities by providing assistance to high poverty school districts, and promoting healthy childhood environments through new or expanded high quality child care. I mean, these are just examples, but those are the types of things. Any questions on that?
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So under those kinds of guidelines, how does that work in places like, you know, in rural, small rural communities in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, a majority of our rural communities are considered qualified census tracts. And not all of them, but a majority of them.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Please continue.
Okay. Okay, I almost skipped one. All right, the second eligibility criteria from the Act was to respond to workers performing essential work with premium pay. And as mentioned previously, Treasury is encouraging us to look at those that were working throughout COVID. So we look at essential workers. They give examples of professions that they consider essential workers. And they do define essential work as involving regular in-person interactions or physical handling of items that were handled by others. And so they want this to go towards people who were more at risk of exposure. So you cannot receive premium pay if you were teleworking. They also want the program to focus on lower income individuals. And they stress that pretty emphatically. And if you choose, and even for grant recipients, so if we set up a premium pay program and we give it to businesses to reimburse them for providing premium pay to their employees, and they give an across-the-board premium pay instead of looking at just their lower-income workers, then we have to put on our state website justification for why we think that's meeting the COVID impact, because they really do want it to focus on lower-income workers.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So a restaurant, for example, could you argue that pretty much everyone in a restaurant is low paid, except for maybe the owners, and maybe they're even getting little or no pay right now?
It's through the chair, Representative Wool. So they defined it as if the premium pay would not take them above 150% of the average wage for the area, Alaska, let's say, then that's okay. If it's over that 150% of the average wage, then they want you to add the additional justification for it.
Oh, yeah, thank you, Ms. Co-Chair. So educators, I'm assuming teachers mm-hmm. are included in that group. So if I don't know how premium pay. If they would qualify for premium pay, they also would have to be no more than 150% of the average, and let's say the average is 50, so mm-hmm. nothing above 75,000, basically, is that?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I believe that is correct. I mean, not to say that you can't go above and beyond, you just have to add the additional justification for it. You can, premium pay, it says up to $13 an hour, so you could say we're only gonna give them $10 because that keeps us under that 150%.
Hold on, follow up, thank you. So if a, would there have to be a premium pay sort of allocation set up that would then these entities would apply for, whether it's a school district or a restaurant or a grocery store, would there be a central sort of bank, so to speak? I mean, would have to be a budget allocation for premium pay that I haven't seen in any budget yet.
Through the chair, Representative Wool. So again, it depends on how we develop programs. So if we wanted to set up a program specifically targeted to premium pay, that would take a specific appropriation, or you could say that the business program you want us to set up isn't just looking at revenue loss, it's looking at COVID expenses, it's looking at premium pay expenses, it's looking at, and so if they incur any of those costs, they could submit a request for reimbursement. It just depends on how we develop the program.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair. I guess Ms. Harbor, the last sentence there in blue, the mismatch between employment-related health risks, and maybe I apologize if this has sort of been answered, but you know, it strikes me that a year ago, if someone said, you know, I have a pre-existing health condition, what do you think, Andy, should I go wait tables? I think we could get killed doing that. Whereas now, I don't think that they could, especially if they've had two vaccines. So can we qualify by looking back in time?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes. As Treasury encourages looking back at people who've worked throughout the COVID period and providing them premium pay for that work that's already been completed.
Follow-up.
And now, looking prospectively, the sort of anecdotal data, that's the newest term we hear in the building, relative to childcare is the employer side is saying, you know, unemployment is too generous, we need our workers back. The workers are saying, your pay is inadequate, we can't survive on your pay. Mm-hmm. So it strikes me that a premium pay scheme there could satisfy both sides. Is that am I onto something, in your opinion?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. So all I can say is that the guidance says that we should prioritize compensation to those lower income eligible workers that perform essential work, and that we can look at retrospective work they did during the covered period, and prospective work that they do from here through the covered period. So we can do both.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Please continue.
Moving to the third piece of guidance, this was related to the provision of government services to the extent of reduction in revenue. So this is the discussions around using ARP money for offsetting of general fund expenditures. The way that the guidance has provided information on how to calculate that loss in revenues involves what they're referring to as a counterfactual revenue trend. So the graph in the bottom right is trying to depict that concept. So the base year revenue is the most recent calendar year revenue, And our next slide will have information on the actual state of Alaska revenue. But they ask to calculate a trend of revenue for the prior years, the several years prior to that base year revenue, calculate the trend of revenue changes over that time period, and then apply those into the future as if they had continued through the COVID, through the public health emergency and any revenue losses we incurred, and allow us to credit that difference between actual revenue and that counterfactual trend line in our favor when we go and utilize ARP dollars for provision of general government services unrelated to COVID response. So it's these light gray areas on this bar chart that would be, in sum total, the amount that we could apply to ARP for use for general government services. And I think this will make a little more sense on the next slide with some actual numbers. So as we tried to work through the calculation in the guidance, we worked with the Department of Revenue, the Economic Research Group, who does State of Alaska revenue projections, to have them look at actual revenue collected, current projections of revenue, and do this calculation. So you can see here on the top of the slide the gross adjustment estimate. And so this is trying to calculate out that percentage trend line. So you can see fiscal year 16 through 20 and the percent change between 16 and 17, 17 and 18, and 18 and 19. And then they take the three-year average of those percentage changes to get a 12.2% pre-COVID escalation rate in state revenues. And so that's really because that start of that base period, we had fairly low revenues, and we saw, you know, some increase in revenues here. One thing you'll note is that we've removed a lot of certain types of revenue. So as you look at total state revenue, inclusive of all sources, there are some of those revenue pieces that in the act, in the interim final rule, it calls out, you know, certain types of revenue that we should exclude, one of those being investment revenue. So we've pulled out any revenue that is, you know, deposits from the permanent fund into the earnings reserve account, which by some definitions count as revenue to the state from investment. But for the purposes of this calculation, that gets removed, and so does the percent of market value draw from the earnings reserve. So these revenues are really just unrestricted and designated general fund revenues per a Census Bureau definition. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of stressing that because it's very hard to take these numbers you see on the screen and tie them back to any revenue sources book published by the Department of Revenue, because as you work through the interim final rule guidance, it leads you to a different way of reflecting state revenue than we normally do. So all that to say, they calculated a 12.2% growth rate. The interim final rule says the greater of 12 of your calculated or 4.1%. So for us, that will be the 12.2%. You then take 2019 base year general revenue and extend that forward on a 12.2% per year basis. And that gets our counterfactual revenue, which is what the guidance refers to it as. So actual revenue, and this is using our spring forecast, you can see there is significantly lower than the counterfactual revenue. That results in a fairly large amount of revenue loss estimate based on this calculation. So you can see in the first year, in calendar year 2020, which has been closed, this calculation leads us to be able to credit $1.8 billion in revenue losses to the ARP guidelines. So quite easily, we know through this calculation that we can utilize any amount of the funding through ARP for this general fund offset ability.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Well, you answered one question, because I'm like, those are billions, so those aren't, there's no indication of what the unit divisor is. But typically we see thousands of thousands, but this is thousands of millions. And it looks like the 17 to 18 increase of 26% really kind of determined that we're on a pretty good growth clip for those years, and averaged out, that's 12%, so that's good. And you're saying that these numbers of, say, 2020 of 2.7 billion, what revenue source can you, and you said it's not typical, you can tie that to a revenue source. That's not POMV or royalties. Is that just a, I'm just curious what that number is from. And I guess going with a 12% average, that's not what we get, but that can justify about any revenue loss we want to justify, it looks like.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Wool. So the 2.7 billion would include so it's based on the Census Bureau definition of revenue. So it's not based on our normal definitions of revenues, because those differentiations between unrestricted or designated general fund are really a internal to state of Alaska concept. So this revenue is a mix of various revenue sources you would see in the revenue sources book, but it does not include things like federal revenues to the state or the POMV revenue, because we're considering that to be, you know, an extension of state investment revenues. So that's because it is really a, from a sort of outside the lens of Alaska fiscal policy, it's a draw from a savings account effectively, and not a true revenue to the state. So this 2.7 billion, you know, doesn't necessarily tie to any normal reporting that we would use in our state budget process, but fits more to a Census Bureau definition. But the bottom takeaway really is that because in that base period we had a year where revenue jumped considerably from a, you know, very, very low level, that percentage escalation gross rate that's calculated is rather high, which leads you to a very high counterfactual revenue and allows us to claim a fairly large amount of revenue loss.
Follow up? Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So, well, two things. If there was a negative year before then you'd have a downward slope, which might eliminate us from eligibility at all. And I guess my other question is that 26% gain from 17 to 18, and I know this isn't, like you said, through the lens of Alaska and UGF, DGF type things, what was that increase? Was that oil? Because I can't imagine what other, what jumped up so fast? Was that the year of the POMV?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, so I'll not wade too far into you know, the revenue trends. I'll leave that to Mr. Stickle at the Economic Research Group. But in that year, there was a jump up in traditional revenues from a fairly low level in 16 and 17. And you're right, had this been a different time period for this trend line, you could have seen, you know, those reducing revenue years would have made a counterfactual revenue trend of negative. But because of the base years, that leads us to a calculation of 12.2%.
Oh,
yes.
I'm just curious what jumped up 26%. Was it POMV revenue? But maybe I'll have to wait for Mr. Stickle.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, it was not POMV revenue. That was excluded from these numbers.
Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Mr. Stringer. This slide, I mean, as a practical matter, is its importance in that it reflects that we could replace UGF dollars, and I use the word liberate them, and use federal resources all within the book, quote unquote. Of course, when we do that, it means we're not spending them on tourism and small businesses and nonprofits, et cetera. But that's the net effect of this slide, right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's correct. Is that the capacity for that revenue offset is enough that we could use effectively the entire amount. But as you point out, there's that tension between the other actual relief out into communities.
Please continue.
So slide 12 is going into a little bit about the provision of government services and what the act means by that term. So it can include a pretty broad broad amount of spending. So maintenance of buildings or infrastructures, or infrastructure including roads, modernization of cybersecurity and protection of critical infrastructure, health services, environmental remediation, school or educational services, police, fire, public safety services. So all of those core services we think of when we think of government services. However, there are some items that it does not include. And we use the phrase would not include here because that's specifically how they phrase it in the guidance itself. So it would not include interest or principal on outstanding debt. So used for debt service, while it, you know, functionally, mechanically would be easier to credit this in the state budget, it's been called out as ineligible. Judgments or settlements against the state, or just deposits into a rainy day fund directly. So it has to actually be tied to an expenditure in the state budget. And a little bit later, we'll get to some of the reporting requirements. But the important piece here is that the use of revenue offset does have to be tied to a specific cost in the state budget and appropriated that way to ensure that we can track that we're using this revenue offset on eligible government services per the terms in the act.
Ms. Harper?
Again, Paloma Harper. I just wanted to clarify, too, that just like the rest of the lists in the guidance, this is a non-exclusive list. It's just examples of government services that can be covered. There are obviously other government services that could also be covered. These are the only exclusions that they called out.
Okay. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I probably, just to clarify then, so you have the police, fire, and other public safety up there. Would that also include corrections?
Through the Chair, Representative Johnson, yes, under other public safety services.
Okay. And then what kind of clarification could you say on the modernization of cybersecurity, including hardware, software protection, critical infrastructure? Would that include, is that mostly purchasing and upgrading, or does it include like planning and so on? Do you have any idea?
Through the Chair, Representative Johnson, it would include, you know, purchasing of hardware or software, kind of operational costs within, say, the Office of Information Technology in the state. Planning, I'm not sure if it's called out directly.
Through the Chair, Representative Johnson, it's not called out directly, but the guidance regularly states that costs to ensure effective implementation are covered. So if you need to plan your cybersecurity approach, that would be making sure you're being effective in your implementation.
So just following up on that, so we've had a couple issues lately with the court system and health social services. So potentially then analyzing what happened and with that and maybe with some other things might be able to be covered, it sounds like.
Through the Chair, Representative Johnson, I believe so.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, so now for the last eligibility criteria from the Act, which was to make necessary investments in water, sewer, or broadband infrastructure. So to make this a little bit easier on states in providing flexibility in determining highest priority water and sewer investment needs, Treasury chose to align this funding with existing federal programs again, through the Environmental Protection Agency, the Clean Water Program, and the Drinking Water Program. And this was just for ease of saying, if it was eligible for those, it's eligible for this. And so if it's a priority in either of those areas, it's automatically eligible. For broadband infrastructure, they do want recipients to focus on areas with no connection or with low connection. And they outline what that means, and it's 25 Mbps download speeds and 3 Mbps upload speeds. They consider those insufficient. And so if you invest in an area with no broadband or low broadband, then it's eligible. But to be an eligible project, it has to result in a certain level of performance. To be an eligible project, it has to result, after it's completed, in an upload speed and a download speed of 100 Mbps. The guidance does specify that if that is impractical because of geography or other things, they do give an alternative to where you can meet. Again, I'm not a technical person, so I'm going to read. If in instances in which it would not be practicable for a project to deliver those service speeds because of geography, topography, or excessive costs, then there is an alternative where you can meet just the 100% Mbps's for download and between 20 to 100 with upload. And then it can be scalable up to that 100 for symmetrical speeds. And again, I'm not an IT person, but hopefully that meant something to somebody.
So the ARPA money is composed of the non-flexible portion that automatically goes out. We don't have any discretion as where that goes. And then you've got this what's called the SLRF, the flexible spending part. Under the non-flexible part, my understanding is that there's $112 million that has to go to broadband. Is that correct?
Chair Foster, that's correct. And we actually have a slide discussing that a little bit further on in the presentation. Okay.
But there is no mandated amount at this point for water and sewer. Is that correct? And so that would be our discretion if we wanted to take that out of the billion, slightly over a billion that's in the SLRF. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Do we have any questions? Representative Josephson?
Chair, on that topic, so I understand, there's roughly a billion of what someone in the billion coined the SLRF, and then there's this other billion that is more direct and dedicated. The water and sewer is in the latter category, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the water and sewer is in the SLRF category, the discretionary, as is the broadband on this slide. But as noted, there's another $112 million specifically for broadband.
Please continue.
So now we get to what the restrictions were from the Act and how Treasury has clarified their implementation of those restrictions. So as the director mentioned earlier, the Act specifically said that we could not use this funding for direct or indirect offsets to a reduction in net tax revenue that we chose to implement. So if we changed our statute regulation or through administrative interpretation reduced our tax revenue, then we cannot use this funding to cover that cost. And what they did is they set up a framework in the guidance for us to report annually on any change to law, regulation, or administrative interpretation that would result in a reduction in tax revenue. So we have to report that every year. And then we have to identify how we're covering that cost, and we have to prove that we're not using this funding to cover that cost. So that they can ensure that to prevent efforts to even indirectly offset net tax revenue decreases. And so it's a pretty involved reporting process we're going to have to develop, which will be fun. The other restriction from the Act was deposits into any pension fund. And so they did define what they meant by a deposit, and they clarified that it did not include regular benefit payments for eligible employee costs. So we can make those pension payments that are normally a part of our benefit payments, and those are covered by this funding. They did clarify a couple other restrictions on the use of the funding. It cannot be used for federal match for federal programs that don't allow federal funds to be used for match. There are a couple federal programs out there that allow federal programs to match them, but where it can't be, it can't be. And then the funding is subject to the uniform guidance and the cost principles associated with that. So you just have to make sure you're following those principles. And then as we mentioned before, it can't be used for deposits into rainy day accounts and debt payments and the one other one, which was
Representative Josephson?
Settlements or judgments. Sorry.
The Chair, Ms. Harper, this committee had considered seriously and maybe wisely, but rejected an idea of moving $1 billion from the ERA into the ARM board account for pension fund reduction or pension obligation reduction. had we done so, I suppose it could still happen, that would swallow up the revenue loss delta, would it not? In other words, had we done that, we would not have been able to justify and show a reduction in net tax revenue.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, so this is not different than our revenue loss estimates, which this restriction is related to when we choose to reduce our revenue. So let's say we did, through the pandemic, we offset fees because we were trying to help businesses and individuals. We can't use this funding to cover our state costs that we ate or absorbed because we chose to waive fees. This restriction is very much specific to where we choose to reduce our revenue as a state. We can't make the feds pay for that. So the thing that you talked about with pension obligations is not in any way impacted here. That's not a tax. We don't bill, we don't have a tax to cover pension funds.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of a follow-up to that question. We're playing catch up a little bit on our underfunding of our PERS TERS retirement program. Would the catch-up amount that we're chasing that full funding of the liability, does that catch-up amount qualify for this revenue, use of this revenue source, or is that our own? That's our responsibility. I'm suspecting that's the answer.
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, the restriction on deposits into pension funds that state on behalf or state assistance payment would fit under this deposit. That's the restricted deposit. It's the employer contribution on top of payroll is allowable since that's routine payroll contributions.
Yes. And as a follow-up, and maybe I'll see if Representative Thompson wants to weigh in on this, but I believe the investment return on our retirement investment funds has been pretty robust over the last fiscal year, into the current fiscal year, and that unfunded liability, that gap has closed considerably, is my understanding. Maybe you want to weigh in on that, or you have any knowledge about that?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, that is what's been reported to me as well, is that those returns have done quite well. Once the ARM board revises its projections in the fall, we'll see an impact there.
Thank you.
Please continue.
So beyond the robust tax offset reporting that we'll have to do every year, there is additional reporting requirements for this funding. They differ depending on the recipient, so I've tried to outline that here. States, metropolitan cities, counties, and tribal governments, well, all recipients have to provide project and expenditure reports, but the timing is slightly different. States, metropolitan cities, counties, and tribal governments have to complete an interim report by August 31st, 2021, and then quarterly reports from then on. Non-entitlement units don't have to complete their initial report until October 31st, 2022, and then they only have to complete annual project and expenditure reports rather than quarterly reports. And that's to acknowledge the fact that they're smaller communities and to not try and be overly burdensome. Then states, metropolitan cities, and counties with a population over 250,000 also have to complete an annual recovery plan performance report. And so this, for our state, only really applies to the state funding and then to the Anchorage, with only two that meet that population criteria. So we will have to complete an initial report on performance August 31st, and then annually thereafter through the performance period, and then we have to post those reports on our public-facing website. And I did want to mention on the performance reports, Treasury will identify some mandatory indicators of performance, And then recipients can identify other key performance indicators they want to include in their performance report. And additional guidance is expected on that. That's all we know at this point, and we have to give our first report in August. So. So next steps, the interim final rule, this preliminary guidance, was published in the Federal Registry on May 17th, Monday, and there is a 60-day comment period for people to provide input, and then Treasury, after that period closes, they will develop their final rule and incorporate feedback or questions that they've received. Our assumptions, especially the revenue assumptions, there's a number of questions we had on that revenue estimate. What should be included? What should be excluded? It was a definition we're not as familiar with. So hopefully all of those questions will be answered in the final rule, and we will revisit those estimates. And then I mentioned the non-entitlement unit funding. We have not received that yet. As soon as we receive it, we have 30 days to distribute it to the smaller cities. But we cannot distribute the funding until we have a valid appropriation. And so if, depending on timing, we have to, we can request a 30-day extension on that distribution.
Representative Edgman?
Yes, so with apologies, I had to leave, and I wasn't part of the entire discussion this afternoon, but where does the, you know, in terms of what you were just saying about, you know, the final rule and this sort of the final sort of assessment and the state's revenue. The last time we had this presentation, or a few weeks ago, I remember we brought up the idea about the permanent fund dividend and how that might actually play into sort of these estimations. But is that sort of been decided in your mind in terms of the interim guidelines, or is there more to be learned about that?
Through the Chair, Representative Edgman, I believe that that was specific to maintenance of effort requirements and state funding to the university or education. That's a different thing than this funding. The permanent fund dividend does not impact our lost revenue estimates or anything like that. So.
Thank you.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I understand this is a different funding than the maintenance of effort. Will you address that maybe when this is done as far as any updates on your interpretation of the guidelines with respect to maintenance of effort, K-12 university?
Through the Chair, Representative Wool, I didn't prepare a slide for that, but I think we could probably provide an update.
Mm-hmm. And through the Chair, Representative Wool, just for a real brief update, there's a deadline of May 17th to provide kind of initial information to USDOE, which the state received actually a 48-hour extension to. So that information has been submitted to USDOE as kind of the initial step of data gathering in that maintenance of effort process.
Representative Wool?
Follow up. Yeah. So it's my recollection that in this submission, the compact with the university is part of the discussion as far as maintenance of effort. And if that's accepted, then the lack of the decrease in funding to the university at the end of the day won't affect the K-12 federal appropriation. I mean, is that the goal of the administration at this point?
Through the Chair, Representative Wool, roughly speaking, that's correct. The process will involve an application for a waiver where we lay out, you know, the compact and the reasons for the compact not being related to COVID. The determination of that waiver will be up to the U.S. Department of Education, whether or not they grant us a waiver, because based on the calculations as we've done them and sent them that initial information, we don't meet the maintenance of effort requirement. However, you know, we will be submitting a waiver request, and you know, we'll see how USDOE kind of interprets conditions in the state of Alaska.
Please continue.
Slide 17 provides more detail on the capital project funds. This is the $112 million that is fairly narrowly defined as being usable for broadband infrastructure projects. As of now, there is no direct guidance on use of this money. We do know that we will have to put together an application describing the project this money will be used for. And the money should be associated with investments in high-quality broadband as well as other connectivity infrastructure and equipment. It is fairly flexible in that we can design a program that works for the state of Alaska and our geography and various communities. It should also be demonstrated as being designed to meet connectivity needs that were highlighted under the pandemic. So things that provide access to work or education or health that are enabled through use of broadband infrastructure. But again, we don't have more detailed guidelines. They haven't released a timeline for when applications will be due. So this is an area where we're just waiting on more information, but continuing to work within this framework to think of ideas that may be appropriate to apply for the state.
Representative Edgeman and then Wall.
So with all that's going on, it's not like you have enough on your plate. Is there any sort of sense of needing to develop a plan that, as Representative Foster asked earlier, you know, we know $112 million for capital / broadband. We really don't know for water and sewer. I mean, there is no sort of set aside, I guess, in the SLRF money that we were talking about earlier. But any sort of sense about hooking up all this tribal money that potentially could come in the state with what we're getting vis-a-vis the, you know, all of the plans, CARES, CRISA, American Rescue Act?
Through the chair, Representative Edgeman, certainly there is. One thing that I apologize we didn't include in our packet, it's not quite perfectly put together for prime time. We've been trying to get organized around all the pots of money, not just those coming through the state, but those that are coming to tribal organizations, ANCSA corporations, school districts, direct to communities, so that we have a general idea of how much money in each community is available, so those kinds of partnership opportunities that may be available where we can share resources to be a little more impactful. Particularly in some of these infrastructure projects, which in a given community may be more than the state is able to allocate within its discretionary funding. So we're certainly open to those, you know, opportunities to collaborate in regions or communities or with different entities to make this money go a little further.
And, you know, I asked the question because it's obvious there's great need in both those two categories, water and sewer, as we saw before this committee, but also in broadband, as we saw in more than one presentation along the way, at least as I can remember. But it just seems to be there'd be great opportunity and also great opportunity to leverage, if that's at all possible, mm-hmm. private sector, public sector, whatever it might be, tribal funding, non-tribal funding, whatever state money that's out there. So not saying anything, you know, that's, I guess, not obvious.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. It says that applicants will be required to provide a plan describing how they intend to use the allocated funds. Who are the applicants in this case? In other words, if there's $100 million for broadband and my community has areas with very poor broadband and teachers have to park in the school parking lot to access internet, for example, because their neighborhood doesn't have good internet, who would be the applicants in this case? And would they be applying to the state to get access to this money, or is the state applying to the federal government?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, while the actual guidance and the method for applying is not yet public, so far our understanding is it's the state that will be applying, but again, that could change slightly. It could be $112 million for the state with other entities possibly applying. But our understanding now is that it's the state that would be applying.
Please continue.
Oh, am I doing this one? Okay. So we did also want to mention the tribal funding from SLRF. especially given some very tight deadlines that are upcoming, just to get the word out there. So as mentioned in a previous presentation, there was $1 billion that is being distributed equally at $1.7 million per tribe for approximately $400 million to Alaskan tribes. Then there was another $19 billion to be distributed in a manner determined by Treasury. And Treasury has determined that 65% of that $19 billion will be distributed on a pro rata enrollment basis. And 35% of that $19 billion will be distributed on a pro rata employment basis. And both the $1 billion and the $19 billion will be split into two payments. The first payment to tribes will include their portion of the $1 billion and their enrollment portion of the $19 billion. So that first payment, Treasury hopes to send out in May. They have set a deadline for tribal governments to submit for that payment of May 24th. So it's an important deadline. It's right around the corner. Tribes must submit by May 24th to get that first payment. The second deadline is that they have to submit information behind the employment distribution by June 7th. If they do not submit employment information by June 7th, they will not get the employment payment. So because Treasury is going to take the information they received by June 7th to allocate that funding. And so it's a very important deadline that's coming soon.
Okay, any questions? Representative Josephson?
It's sort of an ancillary subject. Can I query? Chair, Mr. Steininger, there's something called the State Small Business Credit Initiative. I don't know whether this is a COVID-related initiative or not, but we apparently have $56 million available for small businesses, and we've timely applied. My question is, which entity within Alaska will be overseeing those funds, and do we have a plan to develop criteria for applications and distribution? It's a two-part question.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'm familiar with the program. I know that the Department of Commerce was working with ADA, or ADT, the Alaska Development Team, on a plan for that funding or for that program. I don't know what the status is, but yes, Commerce was working on that.
Representative Poole.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I guess I got a couple questions. The $19 billion, 65% gets distributed pro rata based on enrollment. I assume that's population. And what's the employment? What does that mean exactly?
Let me look. I do have that here. I'm not as familiar. They've got it. They do have, we included it. Is attachment 3 is the write-up on this funding and the deadlines for the tribal governments. But let me see what they said. Tribal employment information. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar. It says tribes would provide an advantage as compared to enrollment and employment. I'm not sure what they mean by employment. It's not clearly defined. At least I can't skim through and see it. Oh, here we go. Employment data from 2019. That's Treasury considers tribal employment data from 2019. That's all it says.
If I may, Mr. Wolf, it looks like the tribal governments submit the number of their employees and the number of employees of any entity.
Thank you.
Of which the tribal government owns at least 51% of ownership interest. So the employment is of the tribal organization itself or something that they own, not, say, the employment of a particular village. Or
right, okay. Thank you.
Follow-up.
Representative.
Thank you. And this was probably gone over in previous hearings, and I can't remember, but so Alaska is sort of disadvantaged in that we don't have a large population, but we're advantaged in the 1.7 million per tribe, because some tribes, if many of them are affiliated with a village, have low population maybe. And So let's say there's a village of 170 people getting $1.7 million, so that would be about $10,000 per individual. And I know it's not distributed that way. What are the rules or guidelines? And I assume this goes out for several years as well.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, that is correct. They are subject to the same guidelines in the Act and in this guidance that everybody else is for their funding. So it has to be used for all those things we went through.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This particular topic came up in a previous presentation. I can't recall if it was you folks presenting, but like when I see the deadline of May 24, 2021, that's pretty quick. Do we have a sense that this information that's being presented to us is out there for all these different tribes and the infrastructure is in place in those communities to actually comply with some of these requirements and to make sure that deadlines are met and things like that? Is that a problem, a significant problem?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I know that Treasury's putting the word out there. I know that there's a number of organizations putting the word out there. We've been working with AML to try and get the word out to communities on their piece. We've participated in a couple different phone calls between AML and AFN on trying to get the word out on the tribal government piece. We're working on it, but it's hard.
Follow up, and I wasn't meaning to imply that it would be your responsibility to make sure that. I guess what I'm trying to say or trying to figure out is, do you sense that there's an issue on that particular topic? Not saying who's responsible for that issue in any way. I'm just trying to say, is that a issue that is real?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I believe it very much is a real issue. These are very tight turnarounds for a bunch of, 229 tribes. We have to make sure know that this funding is out there and what they have to do to get it. So.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Steiniger and Ms. Harbor, for coming in and giving us some more clarity on the guidelines for use of the ARPA funds that are coming our way. We have on our schedule meetings for Friday morning, Friday afternoon, and Saturday. I don't intend to have anything. We all hands on deck are for the conference committee and just working on the differences between the Senate and the House budget and coming up with the cut sheets, the motion sheets, and working on that. So I don't have anything. Madam Co-Chair, it doesn't appear that she has anything. So with that, I don't expect that we will be having any meetings through the weekend. So just so you know, and if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we will be adjourned. At the time is currently 2:40. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for giving us an update as to when we might likely meet again. You say we're not likely to meet through the weekend. Does that mean that we will likely meet on Monday, or does that not necessarily mean that either?
We don't have anything planned, but knowing that things are always popping up and there may need to be a meeting for something unforeseen, there's the possibility. But at this point, I don't see anything on Monday as well. I think the first conference committee may be on Monday. And so I think most of the efforts will be focused on getting through conference committee. You just never know. So, but no plans. Stay fluid. There you go. If there's nothing else to come before the committee, we will be adjourned at 2:47 p.m. Thank you.